Power reel two.
I should say that this Dutch researcher, a chap called Theo Boyten at Groningen University, of course, has access to German records. And this is how we know that the chap shot down on that day. About the time that we were over Leeuwarden was, in fact, the CO of the squadron. I have his name on file there, if it's required.
It seems extraordinary that the gunner should go through all the protocol of asking for permission before opening fire on three threatening enemy fighters.
We were very green in autumn. His training was even less than mine, I think, although he was a wireless operator gunner. He'd done a wireless course, but not a gunner's course. And there we were on operations. Fortunately, the captain had done a full OTU on Blenheims. He had some 50 plus hours on type, so relatively experienced.
But evidently the gunner did open fire.
I don't remember him doing so, but if we did it, he actually fired the gun, or guns rather, because we had two Brownings in the back. So that was our second operation, and I thought, well, if it's all going to be like this, it's going to be great fun, you know.
And that was the 2nd of August?
That was the 2nd of August. Now, this sort of thing continued. As often as not, we came back through lack of cloud cover, because really, a Blenheim by itself, over Germany or over faced with 109s, has really got no chance. They got 100 miles an hour on us, more manoeuvrable, better armed, and of course they were a fighter, we were not. Anyway, we survived that until at the end of August it was decided that we're running out of crews and aircraft far too fast, and we switched to night operations.
That, of course, was the Battle of Britain period, right in the middle of the Battle of Britain period, but you weren't fighting over Britain.
No, I was. I wanted to mention this, actually, because I feel very strongly that the role of the Blenheims has not been sufficiently publicised. We couldn't tell how many aircraft we destroyed. I guarantee we destroyed quite a lot. And of course, you don't get pilots by bombing aircraft on the ground. Nevertheless, the contribution to the battle was considerable. And most people think the Battle of Britain was all about Spitfires and Hurricanes. And to this day, the Battle of Britain flight is led by a Lancaster. And, of course, at that time, there were no Lancasters in operation. But hopefully this might change if the new Blenheim, which should fly in a few months' time from Duxford, I hope that it will find its rightful place in the Battle of Britain flight. And I really do feel quite strongly about this. Because not only was the effort not recognised. For instance, there were virtually no medals awarded, although we didn't think about that sort of thing at the time. Let me switch off a moment, please. But the contribution to the effort in the public eye was not recognised. Also, historians have tended to say that bombing at the beginning of the war was a very chancy affair and really not worth the candle, that it was very rarely that the targets were hit, if they were identified, they were missed by, they talk about up to 3 miles. And I can only speak from my own experience. And I know that day or night, the target was identified 90% of the time plus. In my case, I can only think of two occasions, which I might come to later on, when they were not identified. Bombing at low level, you certainly can't be 3 miles out from 1,000 feet. And at night, we bombed at fairly low level as well, whenever weather allowed.
You said that after that 2nd of August operation, you felt that it was rather easy. Did the other operations that you took part in during the rest of August change your mind about that?
Well, I didn't want to say that it was easy. I've forgotten what my wording was. I said it was fun, I think, perhaps.
Yes, you did.
Yeah. Well, I was quite happy with my part of the operation, put it that way. Here I was, with just 3 months navigation training, expected to go and find some airfield 600 miles away, then got diverted. We didn't fly in straight lines. In fact, on the way back from the Hamburg area, we flew around Heligoland, taking pictures with a land Leica camera I had, which was rather silly, but nobody bothered us there. It's not easy when you've got enemy aircraft on your tail and you're trying to bomb, for instance. The other thing that stands in my mind, that stands out, was when we went over with cloud cover. At one stage, I wanted to check, and I said there should be a lightship below us now. And pilot popped down under cloud, and there it was, lightship. I thought, marvellous. This works, this business. So you need a lot of luck, but you had to watch very carefully what you were doing, mostly based on map reading. And in the Blenheim, navigator is down in the nose with open perspex in front of him. I hadn't a great deal of experience, but we managed it. But the point I really want to make is that I refute the idea that bombers at the beginning of the war hardly ever hit their targets.
And were your operations over the Netherlands and Germany and France?
Netherlands, Germany, France. During the battle, these were the main target systems. Airfields to begin with. Then when it looked as if Operation Sea Lion might be put into operation, we hit the Channel ports. That part was relatively easy, yes, because we were flying at night. We suffered virtually no casualties. And it was a question of identifying a target and bombing it as accurately as you could. But at night, you could see where your bombs were going from any sort of height, you know. See them explode across target. And despite our lack of training, we learned very quickly. For instance, we learned on a target which was being attacked by the heavies as well, and there were a lot of aircraft over the target. You didn't just sail in saying right, left, 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 steady. We'd circle around outside for a while and wait until some unfortunate was caught in the searchlights. And they either put the fighters onto him or he got the attention of all the ACAC for miles around. You then turned in on the target and made your bombing run, and you could see sticks of bombs crisscrossing all over the target, where this poor unfortunate was trying to escape the attentions of the enemy. That sort of thing. One learns quite quickly.
How did you cope with the night flying once you were put on it?
In view of the fact that I'd hardly ever been airborne at night, I was quite well, really. I will, if I may, cite at least one occasion where it didn't work out. But normally, you can see quite a lot at night if you stay down out of out of all light. Don't look at the instruments or anything, just keep your nose glued to the panel. And even when there wasn't a lot of moon, you could see quite a lot on the ground. Water you can always see. And some places were careless about blackout. In the Ruhr, for instance, you could always see the concentrations of blast furnaces going.
You say that some areas were careless with the blackout. You mean you could see lights of domestic houses and factories and so on?
Not so much that as a general idea that there was more light about. There were patches of light without being able to distinguish with this, and that is a town. You know.
You don't think it might have been a spoof on the part of the Germans?
Oh, there certainly was some spoofing going on, but not for a whole town. They had dummy airfields, as we did, and put lights on those. But I'm speaking of just getting to a target, identifying the position of a town. At least you could. That was a great help, and if you could do that.
How comfortable did you feel about operations at night as opposed to the day? Did you actually prefer them?
Well, one felt much safer. That's for sure. Yes, I think so, because there's an instinct for survival. So long as we were doing as much damage, it seemed sensible to me to do it at night rather than day.
Any operations that stick out in your mind from that latter part of 1940?
Well, yes, perhaps I could give one bit of good news and one bit of bad. We bombed Dunkirk one night. Switch it off. 17th of September, we went to Dunkirk. All the channel ports then were full of barges in preparation for the invasion should it come about. Because at that stage, Hitler was still quite keen on it. His navy wasn't. And on this occasion, we went over and I put my bombs across a quay there and the... and across the barges, and set fire to a large hangar, and a great big fire started there. When we got back to base, it so happened that there were two or three spare aircraft, and the first ones back were given a chance to pick up an aircraft, so we went out again the same night to the same target. And when I got into the Thames estuary, I could see this fire burning in Dunkirk, which had started on a previous visit a few hours before. And so we bombed it again. So that was fairly satisfactory.
What date was that?
That was the 17th and 18th of September, either side of midnight. One operation which did not succeed, we were given the marshalling yards at Ham as a target. And the weather was pretty foul. And for once, we had to go over it, up to 20,000, which is getting near the ceiling of Blenheim. It was very cold. And I did my DR navigation and we waited for a break and there wasn't any. So I decided to make sure that we were east of the north-south rail line going up to Ham. And we came down and the object was to intercept this line, turn north, which would take us to Ham. We came down through all this cloud. And it, certainly below 2,000 feet before we broke cloud, where it was raining. And I was glued to the front panel trying to find this railway. And I thought I got it, so I got pilot turn right. And he turned right and continued to turn right, and the aircraft flipped over. He said he'd lost control, which was quite obvious. As any airman will know, if you bring a cold aircraft down into rain like that, you get icing forming. And the gunner had been saying, you know, there's a half an inch of ice all over, there's an inch of ice, there's an inch and a half now. And it was flinging off the props and banging against the side. It was really very nasty. There seemed to be no possible way that we were going to pull out of this. All I could think of was to pull off the bombs so that it would be rather less of a bang when we hit. And even then, I thought we should have hit the ground by then. But by some miracle, Flying Officer Douch pulled this thing out and clambered away very slowly. And I had to sit by him continually, wiping the instruments clear because, pardon me, they glazed over. As soon as you wipe them off, and I was sitting by him rubbing the faces of the instrument so that he could get this thing up through the cloud again, which eventually he did. And I was very pleased to see the moon, I can tell you. In fact, that was 7 days before my 21st birthday.
So it would have been when?
That made it the 14th of November, which I will check. 16th, actually. 16th of November. So that operation was a failure. But it would have been very difficult to have got to the target any other way. And it was rare that we had anything as bad as that. We were very lucky, and we certainly owe our lives to Douch pulling that thing out.
Did you make these operations in squadron strength, or as individuals, or what?
Always as individuals. The squadron would send out maybe half a dozen aircraft at a time. It varied a great deal. But each aircraft had its own target and its own takeoff time. There was no coordination at all between ourselves or anybody else going there.
What was the reason for that?
Well, there was no question of flying in formation at night, of course. Numbers were so few that they didn't think it was necessary, presumably, to give people time over target or routes or anything like that. We always chose our own route, height. All we got was a target, and it was up to us how we attacked it.
Did the air crews feel happy with that system?
Well, I think so. I didn't know any other at that time. We did see evidence from time to time of other aircraft over the targets, usually Wellingtons or Whitleys from the other groups. A few other Blenheims, of course, as well.
What was morale like in the squadron at this time?
I think good. What you saw was a bunch of young people behaving very much as young people do when they're together. their great interest, apart from operations, was drinking beer and hopefully meeting young ladies, which we used to do on nights off when we could afford it, because pay was very low, unless you remember. Norwich was some the best part of 30 miles away, and what we did was hired a taxi. Half a dozen of us would get clamp into this taxi, which incidentally wouldn't come near the airfield because it had been bombed once or twice and the taxi man didn't want to get too near. They'd take us into Norwich, and we usually go to a pub. Ours was the Castle Inn, or the Castle Hotel rather. And afterwards probably go for an hour to the Samson and Hercules ballroom. Very few of us could dance, so we just stood and looked. Rendezvous with the taxi and home. And then that was our sort of night out that we had.
Did you go in uniform?
Yes. Yes, we did. We lived in uniform. I suppose we must have had some civilian clothes there, I don't know, but don't remember ever wearing them at that time. Unless you were on leave. Sorry.
Did the wings help to attract the young women that you were after?
Not particularly, I think. It was an Air Force town anyway. There were not many people from the other services in Norwich. And certainly later on, I mean, you couldn't compete with the Americans, but I was out of the country by then.
I asked you about morale, but did you ever come across this phenomenon of lack of moral fibre during the war?
Personally, no. I never saw it to recognise it as such. If you were on an operation and it was cancelled, usually you were quite pleased because you say, all right, we've got away with it again for another day. But I don't remember any case of anybody doing anything to avoid going on an operation. I know it happened, but I never saw it.
But if a crew decided that they didn't want to attack the target and they just stooge about over the North Sea or something, could that happen?
I suppose it could. And amongst the criticisms that one heard of the period, apparently that did happen. Of course, that needed the collusion of the whole crew. Also, there was a thing called bombing on ETA. Which I heard about later, when an aircraft would go out and when it thought it was over the target, it just let go its bombs and turn around and come home. But again, I never found anybody admitting to this, or had any suspicion indeed that anybody did it. So that went on until December the 22nd was my last operation.
1940.
1940 on Blenheims.
But you were still with the squadron?
I was still with 18 Squadron. And by then we had a new Wing Commander Sharp, Bobby Sharp, who went on to much higher things in the Air Force. Met him later, actually. And he had come from Bomber Command. And he brought us in and said, "Now look, you've done 30 operations. I'm going to arrange for you to go to the Middle East and have a rest against the Italians," was the way he put it. At that time, there was no operation at all laid down for Blenheims. But the Wellingtons and Whitleys, if you did 30 operations, you were sent off to OTU or for a rest doing some other duties for a while. And so far as I know, we were the first people to complete a tour with Blenheim's. And that was sort of unofficial. And it was also very lucky for us because after Christmas of that year, the squadron went back to daylight operations, and the losses mounted once more. It never got to the stage, I think, that they were in France, where during the last few weeks of the French campaign, as Portal put it, I think, Blenheim squadrons were being used at the rate of one squadron was lasting an average of a fortnight, if you extrapolated the figures at the time. But they were bad enough, you know, bad enough for a policy decision to be made to take us off daylight operations and put us on nights. Why they went back to daylight after the end of 1940, I don't know. Probably because there was a desire to keep up an offensive action around the clock.
So you said you went to the Middle East. What was the voyage there like?
Well, it didn't, like so many things, it didn't turn out quite as planned. We found ourselves on a convoy. We're issued with tropical kit, Wolseley helmets, those strange things that explorers used to wear in the 19th century. And in Liverpool Harbour, we slung all those overboard, and they were floating around the harbour. We decided we didn't want those. We didn't know where we were going, but we were on the Empress of Australia in a large convoy which set off into the Atlantic, having made one false start. Convoy was attacked by submarines and turned back, and I joined it for the second attempt. Then we cruised out into the Atlantic. It was quite luxurious. Instead of four to a cabin, we had six. Otherwise, it was almost like a cruise. We amused ourselves by trying to decide where we were going. And indeed, we did sail straight out into the Atlantic, then south, and finished up a week or two later at Freetown in Sierra Leone. We got off, and by then we knew that we were going to Takoradi in the Gold Coast, now Ghana, where aircraft were assembled and flown to the Middle East and elsewhere for operational squadrons, the ferry unit. At Freetown, the army unit there